Welcome to Space Midrash, where Jewish thought meets the final frontier. Space being this awe-filled cosmos that's just begging us to come and know it, to be greater through it. And Midrash, the Jewish process of drawing from the past, standing in the present, and creating a narrative richer, more inclusive than our ancestors could have imagined. I'm your host, Jacob Sager, inviting you to join me on this journey, where every episode is an opportunity to expand our understanding, connect across generations, and shape a future that honors our heritage while boldly stepping into the unknown. I believe in an artful humanity, ethically thriving throughout the universe, but we will only become those people if we can tell the story of us becoming those people. Welcome to Space Midrash, where we explore the profound intersections of culture, spirituality, and the space age. I'm your host, Jacob Sager, and today we have the privilege of speaking with the esteemed Dina Weibel, a professor, anthropologist, and thinker whose work bridges the realms of religion and space. In our quest to understand the cosmos, we often overlook a critical truth. Religion is in space because people are in space. Wherever humans journey, they carry their beliefs, rituals, and spiritual practices. The cosmos is not an empty void devoid of the sacred. It becomes a new frontier where spirituality continues to flourish and to evolve. Religion is a dynamic force, continually adapting to new environments, challenges, and discoveries. As humanity reaches further into the stars, our culture and religious practices will inevitably transform. The rhythms of Jewish life, the cycles of sacred rituals, and the essence of our spiritual heritage will find new expressions in off-planet societies. The ethical dilemmas posed by space travel challenge us to consider the sacredness of extraterrestrial landscapes. How do we honor and respect these new frontiers? As we leave our mark on the moon and beyond, we must navigate these questions with a deep sense of responsibility and reverence. Space travel also transforms the spirituality of those who venture beyond our planet. The overview effect offers a humbling perspective, revealing the fragility of Earth and our interconnectedness. Dina is also writing about the ultraview effect, which provides a profound encounter with the boundless mystery of the cosmos, challenging our understanding and inviting us to embrace the unknown. Dina Weibel is a remarkable guest whose insights will illuminate these themes with depth and clarity. We're also eagerly anticipating our upcoming book on the Ultraview Effect, which promises to explore what we can learn from astronauts about awe, humility, and exploring the unknown. Join us today as we talk on these profound ideas, seeking to understand how the ancient and the modern, the sacred and the scientific, converge in the vast expanse of space. I am here with Dina Weibel, who is a professor, a writer, a thinker, somebody who I read an article of yours about 2 years ago about William Shatner's first, hopefully his first journey into space. He's still kicking it pretty well in his 90s right now after that. And you've written on a lot of topics on space, and I want to go deep and broad with you today. And my starting question for you is, how do religious studies and anthropology apply to human spaceflight and the history of space travel so far?
I think they do apply. I think, okay, so back when I was in graduate school and I was thinking about doing research in France, it struck me that France didn't seem like a traditional anthropological location. I thought I needed to go to some uncontacted tribal place or something like that. And I remember asking my doctoral chair, is it okay to do anthropology in France? And he said, are there people there? And so as long as there are people there, that's opens it to the study by anthropology. Anthropology of religion, which kind of fits as one of the disciplines that gets worked into religious studies, is really focused on understanding how people bring religion into other aspects of their lives. Anthropology is really holistic. It's kind of like Jenga. Any piece you pull out, the rest of it will collapse. So we can't study religion as just its own thing. It's religion as it applies to politics and economy and gender and all of these things. It ties in. So anytime you have humans doing anything, the anthropologist would believe, religion is going to play some part. And it's there. So I've had people come up to me at events before and say, there shouldn't be any religion in space because religion is a thing humans argue about. So we need to be post-religion and we need to have this. All the people who go into space need to be without religion. And I remember saying to one person in particular, that's nice that you think that, but there is religion in space. Because there are people in space and they're practicing their religions in space. So you can't just make an idea that it doesn't belong there. It really already is, as I'm sure.
How has that anthropology of religion, how has religion on Earth started to change or adapt or respond to the events of the last century that have been this beginning of human spaceflight?
It has had to, because a lot of the things that were believed, I don't know, I'm going to go back a little bit more than 100 years. One of my favorite books that I like to read is something called The Winged Gospel by Korn. I can't think of his first name right now. And it talks about aviation, essentially, and how that affected culture and religion. And one of the anecdotes from that I like is something from Charles Lindbergh's journal. Charles Lindbergh, some huge problems with Charles Lindbergh. But anyway, one of the things when he was a barnstormer and had not been famous yet is they would go into little towns and do demonstrations of flight. And he was approached by an elderly woman who took out her purse and she wanted to pay him to take her to heaven and leave her there. And the idea that heaven is in the sky, that you could go up to the clouds and be with angels, that was something that was believed by Christians, at least for a long time. And then air travel forced a reconsideration of that, because obviously if you were up among the clouds, nobody was seeing anything other than clouds and the occasional bird. It was that kind of thing starts to shift the way that religions understand things. I think also religion and space exploration and physics, I think in general, have one thing in common, is that they're both trying to explain what anthropologist Clifford Geertz called the really real. All religions, according to Geertz, seem to posit that what we're experiencing here and now is temporary or an illusion or something that's not as authentic as what's behind it. And trying to figure out what's really going on is something that both priests and rabbis and imams are looking for, but also the physicists and astronomers are looking for. Where are we? What's going on? How does all of this work? Where did it come from? So I think the more we find out through space exploration, the more that sort of has to be adapted into or actively rejected by different religions.
How should space missions address the ethical dilemmas posed by interacting with potentially sacred extraterrestrial landscapes?
Yeah, this has been a question that's come up recently. And I think it's a good question because I don't think a lot of people were considering it before. So you probably have covered this on the podcast. To recap, there's a company called Celestis. I did some ethnographic research studying one of their memorial service ahead of what was meant to be a launch back in the fall of 2022. And the launch was postponed and eventually scrubbed. But I was there for the memorial itself, got to talk to a lot of the people who were sending the ashes of loved ones. So Celestis is a private company. You can send between 1 and 8 ounces of a loved one's cremated ashes into space. and they will purchase payload on an existing mission. Astrobotics was a company that was sending a lander to the moon anyway, called Peregrine, and Astrobotics had agreed to take some Celestis capsules as payload with them. And they actually are used in some cases as even like radiation protection. It's providing mass that goes into a rocket anyway, always along with other experiments, other kinds of things that are going up. And so it was meant to go on to this lander that was going to land on the moon for other reasons. And it turned out that the Navajo Nation saw this as a violation of an agreement that they'd had with NASA back in the 1990s. When Celestis was a new company, they took some of the cremated remains of astronomer Eugene Shoemaker, who's quite well known, and they were placed onto a lunar lander and taken up to the moon, where they still are. And that mission was successful, and they'd been trying to arrange for another kind of lander, and Astrobotics was one that agreed to it. Celestis will send ashes into like suborbital flights where they're recollected and redistributed to family, or they'll put them in orbit where you actually get tracking when grandma or whoever is flying over. And they do talk about the remains as the person, which I found very interesting. And there's also the deep space one where it goes and it never comes back. So the Astrobotics mission had a deep space component, and it also had the Peregrine lander. When the Navajo Nation found out that cremated remains of something like 118 people and one dog were being sent to the moon, the feeling was that this is something that NASA had agreed they wouldn't do again, at least not without talking to the Navajo Nation. So they sought out the White House. They wanted to talk to NASA about it. The folks at Celestis felt like this was bad publicity, obviously. This was something that they didn't see as disrespectful. They saw it as being a service that they were providing for loved ones. And there's been some discussion about rich people doing this. It's really not. The people who participate in this, it's a little bit more than a regular funeral. If you're going to have somebody cremated anyway, it might be like an extra $10,000 to have them. It's not like everybody's going to do it, but it's not, you have to be super rich to do it. So as it turned out, all the worries were moot because Peregrine had a fuel leak. It never made it to the moon, and they brought it back into Earth orbit where it burned up in orbit. But this raised a lot of questions about, oh, wait, can you have one cultural group that says the moon is sacred? Don't do this. Now, from the Navajo perspective, human remains are a contaminant. And when we look at cultures around the world, sometimes human remains are something sacred that can be contaminated by something else. Sometimes human remains are themselves contaminating. Mm. And it just depends. There's not a universal understanding of that. And so from the Navajo Nation perspective, as it was explained to me, the moon is not just a place, a rock, a natural satellite. The moon is the equivalent of a goddess. That it's an entity that is sacred. And the idea of putting something so contaminating onto the surface of the moon was considered hugely disrespectful. At the same time, from the perspective of these families, and I don't want to downplay, I'm trying to present both of these kind of on an equal framework, just because I want to be fair to everybody. From the families, it was more like this is going to be something where at least a part of Fred or a part of Wendy or whatever is going to be on the moon. And when I look at the moon, I will know that this person is at least some way there. And that connection to the moon is certainly something spiritual. A lot of the time, the people who participate were into space. They wanted to go into space. They never got to go into space. At least one participant that I am aware of was selected as an astronaut, but never flew. And so there's this sense that it's the culmination of that from the Celestis side. Obviously, from the perspective of the Navajo Nation, it's really a huge problem. So I think we're going to see more things like that. And the moon becomes, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on, but as somebody who studied pilgrimage for most of my career, A lot of times, pilgrimage sites, as I'm sure you're aware, Jerusalem is a great example, can be sacred to different people for different reasons. And sometimes they become what are known as contested sites in the anthropology of religion, where there's a continuous who should be there, who has the right to do this, who does this building belong to? The moon has the potential to be like that, cranked up to 11, because the moon doesn't exist in anybody's actual territory, but there is not a single culture that has ever existed on the planet that wasn't aware of the moon and that didn't see it as something special and make up or understand. It becomes a symbol, and there are stories associated with the moon, and those are so varied. So we've got this one object in the sky that is deeply significant to every population on the earth, but has never been touched by any of them. And that there was something about that, but now we can touch it. And that's raising all kinds of concerns and conflicts.
Beyond those ethical questions, as we touch the moon quite literally in all these ways, as we continue to send robots from many companies and nations and hopefully more people and whatever else people bring with them, how does that change the stories of many of the cultures around the world that are moon-centric? If we're going to have time zones on the moon, what does that mean about using the moon to keep a calendar that we don't keep to write checks or do our business, but just to follow holidays?
No, I think that's really fascinating how that is going to change. Probably the best analogy I can think of is, I'm sure you've seen maps and globes where they were incomplete in the 1500s, 1600s, where we look at them now and we're like, that's not what that continent looks like. There were ideas of places, ideas of islands, ideas of there be dragons or whatever. And as that information was filled in, it shifted the way that people understood it. So I think as the moon becomes, it depends on what happens. Right now, it looks like capitalism is going to have a large role to play on the moon, that once we can figure out some additional things like how ownership is going to work, if people can mine on the moon and bring that back to specific organizations. The moon does not have a lot of laws. I've been on panels lately with space lawyers, and apparently you're not allowed to bring weapons to the moon, but that's it. So right now we don't have a legal framework. If things do start to become a situation where people are living and working on the moon, people are mining on the moon, people are looking for water on the moon, there are moon bases, all of the things that are imagined, I think it's going to be much more like a distant place in people's imagination, less than an object. I think of all the sacred places, but it'll probably remain a sacred place that kind of underlies that. It'll become a spoiled sacred place. That's where I think it would go. The reason I'm saying
the sacredness remains for the earthbound, maybe, or would that be experienced by the travelers or the workers there?
The example that I'm thinking of is Mount Rushmore. The underlying mountain of Mount Rushmore was a sacred site to native populations in the area. And the European ancestry settlers who came and saw it were like, this would be a great place to do a giant sculpture. And did it stop being a sacred place? No. But did it become a sacred place that had been spoiled or desecrated or that had been somehow wronged? Yes. And I think that's more likely to be what happens. It also depends on how visible some of this is. The moon right now, we see familiar patterns. We can see the mares. We can see people. We know what it looks like. If anything were to happen to change the face of the moon, one of the things that I always think of it as like the worst case example is it becomes like an advertising space. So it's drink Coca-Cola across the front of the moon. People would hate it. And then that part would be spoiled. But it's possible, I think, for there to be activities happening on the surface of the moon that are not visible from the Earth. And if that's the case, it may be something that's more acceptable.
You talked about pilgrimage, and that is a big piece of your research, which you look into. How do the religious narratives and symbolism and experiences of pilgrimage relate to space travel in its many forms?
It wraps on really surprisingly well when I started to look at it. Pilgrimage is going somewhere to be closer to the divine in general. Usually pilgrimage sites, especially if you're looking at the work of Victor and Edith Turner, are considered tears in the veil between this world and the next. So we have the world, and then we have the realm of God, or the realm of the gods, or the realm of the spirits, or something on the other side. And when you go to a pilgrimage site, whether it's Mecca, whether it's Lourdes, whether it's Jerusalem, there's a sense of being closer to whatever the deity that you're connecting to, or whatever stands in for a deity in that understanding of things. It's a special place. I think it's really easy when we speak of things like the heavens, we speak of celestial bodies. A lot of the language we use for space and a lot of the words that are used to describe heavenly locations and things like that overlap quite a bit. There's also the idea that the true reality is out there in space, that the context we find ourselves in, once we know more about space, we'll understand who we are. And that also has supernatural overlap. So if we say the moon, for instance, is closer to the divine, and there's a lot of argument about that, so I'm not saying the moon is closer to the divine, and I know it depends a lot on the religious beliefs of people, but if it's considered to be that way, and some of the way that Christian astronauts in particular have talked about space, as Shannon Lucid, she was an astronaut whose parents were Christian missionaries in China, and she was actually born in a concentration camp in China and has retained a very strong Christian faith, and she's written about this. When she went into space, she brought along recorded sermons by a minister her family knew, and I found a newspaper article where her minister was saying, "Your dad has been always close to God, but now you'll be even closer." So the idea that space is somehow physically closer to God is a cognitive thing that seems to exist for some religions. And for those who have that, the idea of going into space does take on a very strong pilgrimage thing. What we've seen in pilgrimage is when people interact with the spot, very often other objects are involved. And there are three types of interactions with objects. One is to bring something back. So if you were to go to Jerusalem, if you were to go to Mecca, if you were to go to Lourdes, you would bring Rome. You might bring something back that is from that site and almost retains in some way, at least symbolically, the character of the site. Like, you know that's from that place, and so it becomes very important to you. And we see this almost universally across religions, that like a rock from a sacred place is going to become a sacred rock. Moon rocks are like that. When people brought things back, the astronauts brought objects back from the surface of the moon, I've seen people act very reverently toward moon rocks. This is something, you get to go to a museum and they have it all covered up, but there's this one little area you can touch and people line up to touch it. And it reminds me very much of the black stone in the Kaaba, for instance, in the middle of Mecca. The other thing is to leave something there. A lot of Catholic pilgrimage sites that I've studied, it's very common for people to leave an object behind to indicate that they've made the pilgrimage, like to fulfill the vow. Often it's pictures of loved ones. Sometimes it's other things, like I did work in New Mexico at a shrine called Chimayo, where people take these little metal body parts called milagros, and they will leave them at the shrine. So if you're having eye problems, you get one that looks like eyes and you leave it in the shrine. And that leaving something there to show you were there, to mark your place, astronauts did that crazy on the moon. Obviously, some of it is not, doesn't fit. So yes, there are bags of excrement on the moon because what were they supposed to do with them? There are rovers that are left over. But I think Charlie Duke leaving a photo of his family on the moon, that's a really famous example. During Apollo 15, they left a Bible on the lunar rover. That kind of thing looks very much like a pilgrimage thing to do.
Alan Bean left the wings of, or the patch of the fallen astronaut for whom he replaced on that mission.
The fallen astronaut, the little statue, yeah. And so those, that kind of placement of something is a very common pilgrimage thing. And then the third one is taking something with you to a site and having it changed and bringing it back. So when I was doing research at the Vatican Observatory, I did an audience with Pope as part of a large group, but I was stopped in security because I had literally 30 rosaries in my backpack. And it was because I knew that people in my sphere who were Catholic, having a rosary that was blessed by the Pope would be something amazing. So I took them with me, unblessed, was there. He did the blessing. I took them out and they were now blessed. They had been changed by being in contact with the blessing. I'm not saying it's a literal thing, but I'm saying that there's an understanding of something being transformed through contact with a person or a place. And people bring things into space all the time for that transformative reason. One of the astronauts I have interviewed, I have to use pseudonyms for everybody, but I call her Kara in my research. She had crucifixes that she wore on each of her missions that her husband had given her. And she sees them as being transformed by the experience of being in space. And that idea of taking places to, taking objects to a sacred place, having them absorb or be changed by the sacred place, and then they retain that, is the third way that I see people using objects. So all three of those align actually really well with what we see.
So you studied in the Vatican, or you're doing research in the Vatican at one point in time and had an audience with the Pope as part of that. And you were there in, I read the Vatican has a telescope was part of your studies and visits. Can you elaborate on that ongoing relationship between the Vatican and the cosmos?
Sure. When we talk about the history of Western Europe, at least recorded history, as after Christianity spread through missionary activity through there, you end up with the Western Church and the Eastern Church splitting from each other. And the Western Church up until the 1500s was the Catholic Church, as we know it today. There was an expectation that the way it's been explained to me is that Vatican City, which is a city-state, would, like every other country, need scientists and need astronomers. So when the Pope in the 1800s, and I can't remember which one, unfortunately, I'm not great at listing all the popes, but when it was decided that a Vatican observatory was a necessity, one was set up and it's still extant. It used to be located in Rome itself. Vatican City is in Rome, surrounded by Rome, but there was a lot of light pollution. And so there's a section of Vatican City that's technically outside of Rome, like the way that Alaska is part of the United States, even though it's not part of the contiguous 48. So there's a section of Vatican City that's in a town called Castel Gandolfo, which is the Pope's summer palace. They moved the Vatican Observatory out there, and there are domes with telescopes. These domes with telescopes are not high-tech anymore, and so they're not really used anymore except for events and things like that where people will come and visit them and want to check them out. Instead, the astronomers who live there, and they do have a building that kind of looks like a college physics department on the first floor. Everybody's got their office and they do their work. They have a meteorite lab. They also have a guest apartment, which is where I stayed. And then on the second floor is where the fathers and brothers, the priests, but some of them are members of the orders who are not full priests, like Brother Guy Consolmagno is really pretty well known. Not a priest, but a brother within the order. And then they have their living quarters upstairs, and they've got a few other things where they can go out and have lawn and set up telescopes during events and things like that. And they do a lot of the processing data at Castel Gandolfo, but they have an arrangement in Tucson where they have their own dedicated telescope. And so you'll find that over the course of a year, the members of the Vatican Observatory will be taking turns being in Castel Gandolfo and being in Tucson. And typically they use the telescopes in Tucson to get data and then bring it back and do the research and the writing and the other kinds of academic things from Castel Gandolfo. They also have a summer school every other year, which is open to all countries, all religions, and that's something that they're really super proud of. And the classroom that they use for the summer school gets used for movie nights during their regular week on the weekends, which is fun.
We've talked about how the experience of space has impacted, or how the experience of religion has impacted the space travel experience or is related to it. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about the inverse of that, how the experience of space travel changes a person's spirituality or their sense of self. There's Frank White's The Overview Effect mm-hmm. you've written as well about these ideas, and I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, definitely. When I started doing interviews with astronauts, I was familiar with The Overview Effect, and I think the audience is probably familiar with that. But just to recap, the idea that developed by Frank White, that when astronauts can see the Earth from space, they get a sense of it as a planet rather than a place where they live. It becomes something that they knew abstractly, but it becomes real and concrete, and they can see it, which can be shaking for some of them. It shifts your cognitive understanding of things to really see with your own eyes that we are on a planet. Like William Shatner, you mentioned, I think he really had a very strong sense of that, where he's, my gosh, this is the blue, this is the good part, and the black part out here is death. And that idea that they were, like, he might have noted intellectually, but to see it really threw him. And so for some people, there's that very strong shift that happens when they look at the Earth from space. The typical things you hear are, I realized that countries, it was just all one landmass. There actually isn't a difference. Or the idea, conversely, that I saw it at night and North Korea is so dark and South Korea has got so many lights. So being aware of difference in a real way, being able to see weather patterns and how the storm that hits one part of the Earth came from somewhere else and you were able to track it across the globe. So when Frank White talks about the overview effect, it's this realization of something abstract becoming concrete, but it's also increasing typically the understanding that astronauts have of what they see. And that can be a very profound experience. Usually, I shouldn't say usually, in the literature, in the interviews I've done, when people have it, and they don't always, of the astronauts that I've interviewed, there's been at least a couple who were like, it was cool. I thought I was going to have this tremendous thing, but I already knew the borders were artificial, and I already knew we had a very thin atmosphere. So it just confirmed what I already knew. It wasn't a big deal. Or another astronaut I interviewed who was very much, yeah, the Earth is really fragile. I don't think we're going to survive another 500 years. I think we're going to wipe ourselves out. So making himself aware, which is a kind of an overview effect, that he was deeply pessimistic about the future of the planet, being able to see it from the outside. There are other things, though, that astronauts experience. Oh, I was going to say, too, that for a lot of astronauts, that awareness of the Earth's fragility and understanding it as a planet seems to bring about a stronger ecological consciousness, a stronger commitment to things like preserving the Earth, fighting against climate change, educating people about how fragile the Earth is, trying to undo the effects of pollution, all of those kinds of things. Other things that I've talked to astronauts about in my research that have made an impression on them, one of the things is seeing the moon up close. And not a lot of people have written about that or talked about it, but it's a similar experience to the overview effect, except this time you're overviewing, if that's an adverb, the moon. And the moon does not create the same feelings that the Earth does. The moon is not a warm place that makes people think there's weather and everybody I know is down there and oh, the blue atmosphere and oh, look at the... Instead, it's much more, oh, this is a really desolate place. This is a really deadly place. This is a place where there's nothing alive. And the proximity to it, seeing it as round, seeing the craters close up, I think it's going to be really interesting, assuming the Artemis program continues and the astronauts in Artemis 2 do go back to the moon and orbit it. They're going to be having that experience that nobody's had since the early 1970s of seeing the moon close up. And it'll be interesting to see if it has changed at all, the idea that it's desolate, because in the 1970s, most people weren't thinking about, let's look at this for mining capabilities, or let's look at it in terms of where we can get water. A little bit, but it's only since privatized space stuff has happened where I think we're eyeing the moon in a more practical way, if that makes any sense. Then the other thing that I came across in my research that has been written about a little bit in astronaut memoirs, but not so much in research, is what I have called the ultraview effect. So astronauts that I've spoken to who were in the exact right circumstances for this to happen, and there aren't many because it's a kind of rare circumstance, if you find yourself in complete shadow and you find yourself able to turn off all the lights in your spacecraft and you get dark adapted, if you look to the Milky Way then, away from the Earth, you can't see the Earth, you're not looking at the moon, you're looking into space. The astronauts that I've spoken to who've been able to do that have been really blown away by what they saw. One of the astronauts that I interviewed that I call Zach in my research said that when he looked out into space, while he was completely shaded and dark adapted, there were so many stars he couldn't see between them. He said he wasn't ready for what he saw. And it had a very profound effect on him, where he began having almost like a real reckoning with the Drake equation in his head. It's similar to the overview effect, where something that was abstract became real. My gosh, I can understand. I'm seeing how many stars there are, and my brain can't comprehend it. That means there must be other life out there. There just has to be other life out there. That was his conclusion. Instead of the comforting effect of looking at the Earth or the alarming effect of looking at the Earth where you understand it better, though. Okay, I understand weather patterns now, or I understand continents in a different way, or I understand what the atmosphere is. When you look out into the stars, it's more this bafflement. Zach told me, and I'm going to quote him here, it's a little saucy. He said, I realize we don't know crap about anything. We really don't. Just that awful sinking feeling of realizing that everything you felt like you thought you knew, you really don't know anything at all, not even a little bit. And that kind of feeling was something that I saw in astronauts. Another one, he couldn't get crews to be willing to turn off the lights so that he could look out. He had to wait until a later space mission where finally the commander allowed it to happen. And the idea of having to fight for that, because everybody's trying to get their work done and trying to chase the red line and make sure that you're hitting everything you need to do that day. This particular one, I call him Theo in my research, he spent a lot of time pursuing spiritual experiences in space. So looking out into space, he described the stars as a solid white wall. Once again, I would really love to see what they saw. I can imagine it, but I'm not quite sure. And that it was just unbelievably solid. That's another quote from him. And that being in space is a spiritual experience. That, you know, the spiritual progress you can make in space is so much faster than what you would do on the Earth. And he also would do things like, one of my favorite descriptions he gave was, he would wait until it was dark in the spacecraft, push himself away from the wall so that he was floating but not moving. And then he would go into meditation until he would lose any sense of his limbs and his body and just be at one with everything. He described it as Buddhist, but I don't know. He was not a Buddhist by background, so I think it was a shorthand for an like he was imagining a mystical experience. But for him, he grew up as a little kid in a mostly Christian environment, but had gotten very pantheistic on his own without a lot of religious training, and would do things like pray to the stars when he was a little kid. So being in space surrounded by the stars and being able to look out into them was an intensely spiritual experience for him, and encouraged him to do things like meditate in space. Think of it as like a sensory deprivation tank, where instead of floating in salt water, you're floating in microgravity. That experience, I think, is fascinating. And I'm really curious whether NASA will encourage astronauts to have those experiences, or whether it's going to be something where they have to either sneak it, like Zach, it was more of a sneaky thing, like he was out of radio contact with NASA and was able to do it, or at least get permission to do it, or whether they won't be interested at all. But I think as we get further out into space, more and more people may have that kind of experience, as long as we don't somehow light pollute the shaded places.
One comment on the overview effect is at some point in the future, the excitement or that transformation won't happen anymore because the generation can take it for granted because they live in the reality where that's the precedent and that's the past. As we imagine an off-planet future or long-term humanity's habitation beyond Earth, how can earthly cultures and religious heritages, how can they preserve themselves, or how can we future-proof or think like that about these institutions?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not going to be reassuring, because I think religions change. And so that adaptability is going to, human beings are constantly changing to what's happening to them. And I think when humans get out into space, there are going to be experiences and events and understandings of divine intervention and other things that are going to shift religions as much as we've seen them shift on Earth, if not more. Judaism, to take that as an example, you have a lot of different types of Judaism that don't always agree with each other. And that kind of sectarian formation, I can imagine happening in the future. One of the things that I find myself thinking about is on Mars, if people do have, and these become long-term settlements, do you follow the lunar calendar on the Earth? And if you don't want to follow the lunar calendar on the Earth, let's say somebody is shaking for a reform where they want to come up with a new calendar that's going to tie to Phobos and Deimos or something, how does that work? And how is that person going to be charismatic enough to make that argument and then bring the religion with it? And how would that change things? And Christianity, I always think of like the Orthodox calendar and the Western Christian calendar. So you have holidays like a week apart or whatever. I can imagine there being the Martian calendar and the Earth calendar for Judaism or Islam. Or it could be, no, we're going to stick to the Earth because we come from the Earth, where it can be next year in Jerusalem, next year on Earth kind of thing. We don't know what's going to happen, because we don't know if a spaceship is going to blow up, or a spaceship was going to blow up and there's going to be a miraculous intervention and that's going to change the story. We don't know what events are going to take place that might be extremely significant and work their way into the fabric of religions. We don't know how human bodies are going to change over time, if we're living on 1/6 gravity, or if we're living in 1/3 gravity, like on Mars. And is that going to make a difference? What food is available? And how do you work in ritual feasts and fasting if you are in a situation where you're lucky to get a certain number of calories every day and you're going to eat what's available, right? I think it's too hard to predict other than to say there will have to be adaptations. There's just no way around it. And every time we've seen a religion move from one location to another, it adapts, it changes, it deals with new circumstances and adjusts.
Are there any films, books, or articles that have significantly influenced your views on space, even fiction or nonfiction?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Kim Stanley Robinson's book, A Memory of Whiteness. It's a one-off, not part of another series, although I think it is in one of his universes. But it talks about an orchestra traveling from one planet to another in the solar system and how the different populations have evolved to exist on those planets and how societal things have been worked out so that humans can exist. A lot of people, I was just at an ASU event called Space Intersections it was Arizona State University, but they held it at their building in Washington, D.C. And everybody was talking about The Expanse. And it was a very cultural focused thing, but The Expanse and its depiction of different populations having adjusted to different parts of the solar system and the work they do there and how the culture shifts. A lot of people there were really focused on how realistic that seemed. Everybody hates this movie. Not everybody hates it, but everybody hates on this movie, if that's a difference. But I really loved Gravity, even with the problems that it had with the plot and things. And the reason why is the experience it gave in IMAX 3D of doing an EVA was the closest feeling I've ever had. And the first time I saw it with my mother-in-law, the second time I brought my 5-year-old with me. He's not 5 anymore. He's almost 16. But during one of the scary scenes where the astronauts are doing an EVA, he reached out and held my hand, and he literally held my hand for the entirety of that movie. So it's a very mom kind of thing. But when I think of the movie Gravity, I'm literally floating in space holding hands with my child. And that was like, for sure, a really meaningful experience to me.
That's what brings you to my next question is, if and when you go to space, what would you bring with you?
There are so many questions or so many things that I'm thinking about. And I was essentially boiled it down, I think, to two things that I can imagine. And they're both kind of cheats. One of them is a laptop, just because you can put so much on it. So it can be so many other things, like a photo album and home movies and all of this other thing. And the other thing reminded me of when I was doing research in France and having a Kindle of all things with me, because it used to be when I was doing research in the 90s, I wanted books. I wanted my books. And I used to have to somehow ship boxes of books to myself. And the last time that I was doing research in France, I just had all of my books, how many dozens I needed, right on this little wafer thin piece of technology. Those aren't emotional things. I think the idea of going into space reminds me of the idea of going into the field as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer. And I certainly did take objects that my son had made for me, gifts from family members, and I think those kinds of things would remain meaningful. But if I had to only bring one thing, it would be the laptop, as unromantic as that is.
That's a good answer. Thank you very much. That's all my questions. This was very deep and wide today. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
And I hope we should have you on Space Midrash again as the more space history is happening and there's more to discuss.
I'm working on a book right now. The working title, and it's supposed to come out sometime next year, is The Ultraview Effect, What We Can Learn from Astronauts About Awe, Humility, and Exploring the Unknown. And so I'm really leaning into the we don't know crap about anything and how important it is for humans to embrace that and not pretend they know things and make up the decisions based on feeling that they already know what they're doing. I want us to embrace ignorance and work with it.
I love that. Absolutely. We're looking forward to that next year. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This episode of Space Midrash was produced by me, Jacob Sager, right here on planet Earth, 2024.